So Hans Clevers has been one of the pioneers and experts in adult stem cells since his early work in, I think, the early 1990s on Wnt signaling pathways, when he came across the LGR5 gene and realized that it was a marker for slowly cycling potential stem cells in the intestinal crypt, at the very base of the crypt. And he was really one of the people who pushed the technologies to allow us to study adult stem cells, not just in vivo, but in vitro, using very powerful organoid systems. So his work has had relevance both in the development of the intestinal tract, but also in cancer. And he continues, I think, to astound us all with his studies. And I don't want to go through the many, many, many honors that Hans has been awarded, but I just want to say that he's a dear colleague at the Hubrecht Institute, and he actually, this is an institute which is one of the partnership institutes with EMBL, where I'm located now, and it's always a pleasure to interact with Hans because he has always a humorous and philosophical approach to this field, which I think is very important, because stem cells, as you'll hear today, are rather controversial sometimes. And I think it was Hans and Fiona Watt, our other keynote speaker, who will be joining us, well, who's actually online now, but who will be joining us for her keynote at the end of the day. I think it was the two of them who came up with this quote that one has to define stem cells by their function rather than molecularly or at the phenotypic level. They're constant surprises, and it's the capacity to renew that really allows them to be defined. So without further ado, I will pass over to Hans, who is situated in Shanghai, but nevertheless very, very kindly agreed to give this opening keynote talk. So thank you so much, Hans, for joining us, and we're really happy to have you. And thank you, Fiona. We can't see you, but we know you're there.
Well, thanks very much, Edith. I hope you can see my screen now. What I'll try to do is give you some background as to how we developed organoid technology about a decade or so ago. But first, I'll say a little bit about adult stem cells. So here you see a process that we all know all too well, aging. What this really is essentially we're built of tissues. Our tissues are built of cells. These cells work hard. They age, they die, and almost none of our cells will live as long as we do. So evolution has come up with a solution for that, and these are what we call the tissue stem cells or the adult stem cells. They reside in almost every organ, maybe with the exception of the heart muscle and the most large part of the brain. And what these stem cells do is whenever cells are lost, they will divide. That's the only thing they really are good at. They create daughter cells, and these daughter cells then mature into the cell types that the tissue of interest is needing at that moment. What you saw here was a stem cell in the liver that regenerated, as you can see here, a large number of lost liver cells. Now, our attention was drawn to this organ, the gut, a long time ago. In the mid-90s, we discovered that one of the major signaling pathways during development, which is the Wnt pathway, was not only active in development of embryos, but it was also active after birth. And particularly, it was driving the process that I'll be showing you in this and the next slide. So here you see the inside of the gut. These protrusions are called villi. They extend the surface area of the gut such that we can digest our food very efficiently. And they are the so-called crypts of Lieberkühn. And they had been known or suspected to harbor stem cells. And we thought that these stem cells were of particular interest, more so than stem cells of other organs, because of what you see here. You see a cross-section of a villus. You see two crypts at its base. Presumably, there are about 8 to 10 crypts that surround one villus. Cells are produced by stem cells that presumably sit at the base of the crypt. The daughter cells proliferate rapidly. They only take 2 days after they are born at the base of the crypt to exit the crypt, they probably have undergone 4 or 5 cell cycles by then, so it's a massive amplification of cell numbers. When they exit the crypt, they will differentiate out, mature out into one of about 10 different cell types. They have another 2 to 3 days to live while they move up the flanks of the villi. They're now exposed to this very harsh biological environment of the insides of your gut. They specifically pump nutrients and liquids into the blood and lymph vessels into your body. And when they're 5 or 6 days old, at least in the mouse, in human a little bit older, they reach the tips of the villi and they undergo apoptosis. So every week or so, we totally replace the inner lining of the gut. And this amounts to about 100 grams of cells every day. So this must be, we think, the fastest cell-renewing system of the mammalian body. And for that reason, we thought it was of particular interest to try to identify the stem cells that sit at the base of these crypts. And we is here, Nick Barker. He performed a number of experiments in mice using a marker that we found for these potential stem cells, LGR5. With that, we can create knockout mice, in which we mark stem cells in multiple colors. And when we do so, we indeed see that these cells produce large amounts of daughter cells every day. In this case, we start with different stem cells in different colors, but eventually the crypt resolves into a single color. And our animator, Jeroen Huijbe, had predicted that if these indeed are the stem cells of the gut, this should be the outcome of that experiment. So we essentially, we label the cells with different colors, the potential stem cells. We wait weeks, we wait months, we wait years, and we then see if those colors that we mark the stem cells in are still present. And as you can see here, this was the prediction of Jeroen, and these are the real images. So the muscle layer is here. The lumen of the gut where the food is here. So food would pass by from left to right. And you see maybe 20 or so villi and these parallel multicolored bands. And on a blow up, you can see they indeed come from individual crypts. So this essentially are a number of crypts that surround a villus. And you see that this crypt has resolved into a red color, this one and a blue, is a yellow one, a green one. And they produce these parallel bands of beautiful multicolored cells that don't mix much, as you can see here, and make their way in about 5 days from the base of the crypt to the tips of the villi. Now, these cells that we mark in a color will remain active for the lifetime of a mouse, so they are long-lived, unlike all the other cells in the gut. Also, in one of those ribbons, you would see all of the cell types of this tissue, implying that they're not only long-lived, but they're also multipotent. And by our definition, they are the stem cells of this organ. Now, there were quite a few things wrong, actually, with these cells. People had a sort of dogmatic view on what tissue stem cells should look like. And I must say, we held those views as well. And one of them is that they should be rare and sort of magical almost, difficult to find, which these aren't. But most importantly, it was strongly believed that stem cells should not divide so often. They should be quiescent, because every time that a stem cell divides, it has to copy its DNA. It can make mistakes. And the cell might up as a dead cell, or it might up, even worse, as a cancer cell. Now, so therefore, the idea was that stem cells would not divide much, but the daughter cells that only are short-lived should divide a lot. Now, this is a good idea, but it actually doesn't hold true, because the stem cells that we find divide every day. Actually, they take only 23 hours to go through one cell cycle, and they do this lifelong. So in a mouse, they go through about 1,000 consecutive cell divisions. Immense logistics, but they manage to do this. And in humans, the prediction would be that they go through 20,000 cell divisions in the lifetime of a human being, the same original stem cell. Now, based on this, we then, and we is now Toshi Sato, Japanese gastroenterologist in the lab back in Tokyo since a number of years. We thought, well, can we culture these cells? Can we expand them in vitro? And the idea was to make a lot of stem cells out of a single stem cell. It was then believed that normal cells cannot be cultured long-term, cannot be expanded, despite the fact actually that Howard Green had shown, and Fiona might talk about this, that skin stem cells, epidermal stem cells, can be expanded in vitro dramatically, and also embryonic stem cells can be grown for a long, long time while remaining normal. But the general belief was that the average tissue stem cell, will maybe live for a week, but will then die. Now, we knew quite a bit about the growth factor conditions in the crypt. So the stem cell factors that these stem cells need, and you see them here in the top, our spondin is a Wnt activator. We later found actually it's the ligand of our LGR5 receptor. Epithelial growth factor is always good for epithelia. And we knew we had to block BMP signals, and we do that with a protein called Noggin, three recombinant proteins, in a 3D gel, collagen laminin called Matrigel. And we put a single cell in, and we indeed saw a rapid growth of these stem cells. But rather than creating a lump of stem cells, we started creating structures. And Toshi looked at these for a few months and then slowly started realizing that what is growing here, and this is a movie that runs over a few days, so you can see how enormously vital these structures are. Actually, these are phenocopies of the normal gut epithelium. It turns out that there is a central lumen in these structures, and the central lumen is lined by the very same cell types that you see in the gut lumen. So about 10 or so cell types that we distinguish there. And these buds turn out to be crypt equivalents with stem cells at the tips, Paneth cells and other cell types sit in between the stem cells. And then the rapidly dividing daughter cells make up the rest of these protrusions. It's really remarkable how well a single stem cell with three growth factors, no serum, in a very simple gel, how it actually manages to recapitulate a lot of the characteristics of the original tissue. Now, we looked at these things forever. They've been growing for many years now, much longer than the original owner, a mouse in this case, would have ever lived. We still were worried that these cells probably in this process will convert into a cancer cell. Now, by sequencing, we never saw oncogenic mutations, but the ultimate test was a transplantation. And what Toshi did is he took a single red fluorescent Dutch LGR5 positive colon stem cell in this case, grew them up to about 100 million cells, sent them frozen to Tokyo, our collaborators Mamoru Watanabe's lab. They had treated mice with DSS, which causes these ulcers that you see here. And they infused these gut organoids through the anuses of about 30, 40 of these mice. And in the next hours, happened what you just saw. So they float around. They will not attach to healthy epithelium, but the moment they see subepithelial structures like collagens, they will adhere with the integrins on the outside, and they'll open up like a living band-aid and seal these lesions. And the mice that receive these organoids actually cure much faster than the control mice. Now, this is a real experiment here. You see a colon left in the top with these red patches. So what is black is the Japanese colon. What is red is the offspring of this single, I stress, a single stem cell that is red fluorescently labeled. And the only way by which you can find these patches is by looking for the red fluorescence with a confocal microscope. And by all means, this is now normal tissue. On the right, you see a number of marker stainings that we did. And it never these patches never developed into cancers. That would have been one prediction. Also, we never saw exhaustion. Had the stem cells had been expanding so much in culture that some stem cell biologists would say they will be exhausted. They might make a little bit of tissue, but then disappear. This also does not happen. So it's really remarkable that these organoids, as we now call them, Toshi used to call them mini guts, that they on their own create an enormous amount of tissue. It looks like there's no end to the amount of tissue they can make without turning into a cancer cell or without being exhausted. And when you transplant, they make normal tissue. And based on this, Mamoru Watanabe, you see his name in the slide here in Tokyo, has gone on to do human-to-mouse transplants. This was mouse-to-mouse, and is currently in the middle of a trial doing human-to-human transplant, also for inflammatory bowel disease. So we're very anxious to hear how well that will work. Now, since then, we found that this is not something special for the gut. We can play the same tricks in essentially every internal organ that we and other labs have tried. The protocols, so the cocktails of growth factors, are always slightly different. Some of them are very complex, but they always contain at least a strong activator of the Wnt pathway, a strong activator of a tyrosine kinase receptor, like EGF or HGF or IGF, and an inhibitor of BMP and or TGF-beta signaling. And on top of that, for instance, for breast tissue, you would add estrogen. For prostate tissue, you would add testosterone, et cetera, et cetera. But the basic cocktail is always very similar. We start these cultures not from stem cells. We just take a little bit of tissue, grind it up in small pieces, 10, 20, 30 cells in a clump. stick it in the gel, add the growth factors, and within a matter of 1 or 2 days, the epithelial compartments of the organoids will start growing. They make organoids. Everything else under these conditions will die. So immune cells slowly disappear, muscle, blood vessel, fibroblasts all slowly disappear, nerves. The only thing we keep going is the epithelial compartment of an organoid. And you'll have to realize that the epithelial compartment of the internal organoids are really the business ends of these organs. In the lungs, in the liver, the pancreas, and the prostate, and the breast, it's the epithelial cells that perform the specific function of that organ. And that almost always are also the prime targets, the principal target of disease processes. And I'll give you examples of them. Now, some pictures. This is a lung organoid with the ciliated cells, so that essentially beat and move mucus out of the airways into the oral cavity. This is liver, and these actually are particularly nicely structured, these organoids. So the liver cells, the hepatocytes, are very large cells, very large nuclei with big nucleoli. They make lots of albumin, other serum proteins. They also are the chemical factories of our body. And you see these little canals that run here. They turn out to be the so-called bile canaliculi. So hepatocytes pump bile acids into these canaliculi, and then they reach a central space here and here. And that's where the bile ducts should be hooked up. They're not in this type of organoid yet. And they will take the bile out of the liver eventually into the gallbladder and the duodenum. We can transplant these as well. This was now done by Ipe de Jong in New York. In red, you see large islands of healthy human hepatocytes grown as organoids, transplanted into this blue background is the liver of a mouse that has hereditary disease. And as a consequence, when it's put on normal food, it'll slowly intoxicate its hepatocytes. And this creates room for the transplanted human hepatocytes to slowly take over the livers of these transplanted mice. Again, proving that you can basically expand these cells in culture for a long, long time. The moment you put them back into a living organism, they will revert to a normal behavior. They might proliferate a little bit, but they'll usually be very well behaved. With these organoids, we can build all sorts of disease models. What you see here is I put in here foie gras. So it's an organoid that we have loaded with fat, and you can see these lipid droplets. It really looks bad at the outside, but we can actually add so-called DGAT inhibitors. This is one of the enzymes that creates triglycerides out of its precursors. And when we block that enzyme, you can see that over a matter of, 4 days, the organoid entirely clears up, so the droplets disappear. And you can also, if you compare here on the right, the top left and the bottom right, it also grows in those 3 or 4 days. We've gone through a large number of candidate molecules that people are trying to develop, pharma companies trying to develop to treat fatty liver disease. It turns out that only 2 or 3 out of the 25 that are in development, at least in this assay, will help get rid of the lipids. So we think it's an important platform that might help shift through candidate drugs for the treatment of fatty liver disease, for which there currently is no therapeutic approach to clean these livers. Then there is a technology that is not developed by us, and also we don't use this particular approach. It starts from pluripotent stem cells, so not from tissue stem cells as we do, which we can get directly from an adult body, from a biopsy or surgical resection. This starts from iPS cells or ES cells, so these pluripotent cells, and I hope that this works. Yeah, here we go. So what you do in this case, you grow these pluripotent cells that have the potency to become everything. They can make any organ, but they have to be taught how to become one of those organs. And what is done at the beginning of these experiments is these iPS cells are spun down. So you get a little clump of totipotent or pluripotent cells. They can become anything, but now they have to be instructed. And that's happening here. So they're put in a gel, much like what we do with our adults. That's happening here. So it's sort of floating in the gel. And now it's taken through a complex protocol that for mini brain that you see here might take a half year, much like it would take in a developing fetus, by changing growth factor conditions, 2 weeks this, 3 weeks that, shaking, not shaking, and eventually you get these beautiful looking brain structures that you'll see at the end of this movie, where many of the structures of the human brain are recapitulated. And this is the first time here you see the outcome of one of these experiments. So this is the first time that it's now possible to study the human brain in culture, although it's still imperfect. People are still working hard to make these assays better and do things like study how Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or Huntington's, et cetera, develop. But also the normal physiology of the brain can now be studied in these tiny little mini brains. And this alternative organoid technology, so that doesn't start from tissue stem cells, but starts from iPS cells, can also be used, for instance, to make beautiful versions of the kidneys, so-called mini kidneys, as done by Melissa Little. Now, going back to our version of organoid technology, we can grow from any internal organ now mini organs in a personalized fashion for an individual patient. This means that it's probably still even easier to grow cancers, and that's what we do here. So side by side, on the left, you see this is Dutch, gezond, healthy. On the right, you see sick, tumor. We go side by side, I guess never done before, healthy tissue and tumor tissue from the same individual. We can then perform all sorts of diagnostic assays, like reading the DNA of these organoids and find where the oncogenic mutations are. That could have been done directly on, of course, on the tumor, although the sequences are very clean. But importantly, we can expose these organoids to a large number of different drug combinations and ask, what is the best drug combination to kill the cancer cells of this particular patient? And this would be the readout then. Since the past 3 years, a number of papers have appeared, probably around 20 now, where it turns out that this approach is very powerful. The predictive value is in the order of 85 to 90%. So if you read out that a particular drug combination will work, 90% chance that it indeed works in the patient. And when it will not work in an organoid, again, 85 to 90%, it will not work in the patient. So this is, we think, very promising. At the moment, this is still too slow. It takes 5 to 6 weeks at least to get a readout. That's not fast enough to be meaningful in the clinic. It's also very expensive, and you need very skilled personnel to do this. So you would never be able to do the diagnostics for all the cancer patients that one sees in the hospital every year. But there are currently multiple companies trying to automate this and also miniaturize the assays. And it looks now that it's possible that one can do this in a matter of a week, and maybe for the cost of about 500 euros or something like that. So then it would be a really helpful tool. And I need if the statistics hold up of 85, 90% predictive value. This is much higher than what currently is done in diagnostics for cancer, where overall one would probably estimate that only 40% of the patients that are given a treatment benefit from the treatment, and the 60% don't, but all 100% suffer from the side effects of, as we all know, pretty harsh drugs and radiation therapy that are used to treat cancer patients. As you can see here, this can be done for a whole series of carcinomas. That is particularly what we can grow. These are epithelial in nature. And people are still, many labs are still adding protocols to this portfolio. Now, what we can also do is study cancer basically, so fundamentally in the lab. Bert Vogelstein 30 years ago already proposed that colon cancer, which is also what we have been studying a lot in the lab, comes about by a series of relatively ordered series of mutations in a number of cancer genes, APC, you see it here, KRAS, P53, SMAD4, which is the one in the middle here. And this would take a normal cell gradually through benign stages, early, intermediate, late adenomas, into an invasive and eventually metastasizing colon carcinoma. We use here a technique that you're probably all familiar with, introduced by Jennifer Doudna and Emanuela Charpentier in 2012, CRISPR. And you see here in the movie how it works. So essentially, an enzyme is targeted by a short RNA molecule to a very specific sequence in the genome, causes a cut in the both strands, so a double strand break. If you at the same time provide a piece of DNA as a template to seal that lesion, you can actually change the sequence nearby the gap and correct, for instance, a mutation. And this is actually a movie that we took where we did this for cystic fibrosis in cystic fibrosis patients in 2013. So using this CRISPR technique, we have, as again in the movie, what we have done is we wanted to recreate this healthy to early adenoma, late adenoma, and then carcinoma sequence by sequentially introducing the four most common mutations that are seen in colon cancers, starting from a normal colon organoid. I already showed you that when you transplant those, you get normal tissue rather than cancers. So we target APC. We need to hit both alleles. That's happening here. Double strand breaks. We get frame shifts if the cell repairs this. We have now organoids that have one mutation in APC. They, by the way, no longer need some of the growth factors. P53 is very commonly mutated in many solid cancers. We can target it again. And now we have two mutations, probably 1 month and a half into this experiment. The third one, KRAS, that's an oncogene. So we have to cause a double strand break, but then replace it by the oncogenic mutation. Now they have three mutations. And then finally, SMAD4 is a transcription factor on the BMP pathway. We target it again with Cas9 CRISPR, and we end up with an organoid that has all four mutations. You see it on the left. Now, in this process, we get all other combinations as well. You can do it in any order. You can do it all at the same time. Eventually, the readout would be to now transplant it orthotopically, so in the colon of mice, and see what happens. But the outcome you see here. So on the top right is a full-blown invasive metastasizing colon cancer in the colons of mice. So it's a human cancer. And on the left from that, you'll see the different combinations where we only have three of the four mutations. There's one that does grow like an adenoma, the others hardly grow, and the ones with one or two mutations don't grow at all. And so this really, I guess, establishes that you can use normal human organoids to recreate cancer. And we and other labs have used this method a lot now to figure out how individual cancer mutations lead to cancers, contribute to a malignant transformation, but also how, for instance, individual drugs will be affected by particular mutations in cancers. Two short stories, then I'm done. This has also been used for infectious disease. The first one that we did is Cryptosporidium. Before that, Marie Estes in Texas did norovirus, which could never be cultured in the lab on cell lines. Cryptosporidium, the same. It's a complex eukaryotic parasite related to malaria, goes through asexual stages and asexual stages. I'll show that in the next slide. And we hope to be able to recapitulate this whole life cycle in an organoid. It again was not possible to grow these parasites on cell lines in a lab, and they're harvested from cattle, if you want to do research on this. So cattle are infected and they produce these oocysts. You can buy them. Here's one of those oocysts. Here is an organoid, and we're going to inject, you see that here, the oocysts into the organoid. And we hoped that because the organoid has a lot of different differentiated cells, as they would be present in a normal gut, that now these parasites would find their real host cell and be able to start up their life cycle. Now that happens. So here you see the oocysts landing on top of the epithelium. There's a few sporozoites, four per oocyst inside. They will come out, as you can see happening here. And they will now go through a few amplification steps. So they go for the cells that they like. It turns out that for all stages, these are the enterocytes, so the cells that take up nutrients in the gut, fully differentiated, not present in cell lines, but abundantly present in organoids. Type 1 mirrors are formed. Again, you'll see cell divisions inside. Type 1 merozoites come out. They start the next amplification step. I think they'll infect another enterocyte soon. See that happening here. And I think the next stage will be now that they will now enter the sexual stage, much like malaria would do. For that, they have to start to form different structures. That's happening here. So it'll be a testis equivalent in the front and an ovary equivalent in the back. They're called, as you can see here, micro and macro gametes. Inside, you see the gametes coming out. So these are the male gametes, the microgametes. They actually, one of them makes it to the female gamete, fertilizes it, and now a newly formed oocyst is formed. And this will now leave the body of the infected human or animal, causing a chronic intestinal infection. Happens a lot in the third world. It's not a good disease to have. And eventually you take it through the entire cycle. And here you can see by EM, just showing that, that what I just showed you, Dean, happens, that we see all of the ages of this about 3-4 day life cycle. We see it present in these oocytes. So another one finally is just a few slides. COVID, early last year, it was clear that, that COVID was a bad disease, a lung disease, pulmonary disease. There were also some indications that it would be bad in the gut. And we knew that ACE2, the receptor, is very highly expressed in the gut, much higher than anywhere else. We worked together with our colleagues in Rotterdam, you see their names on this slide, got some virus, infected it, our intestinal organoids, they were readily infected. In white, you see a protein, a nuclear protein of the virus. On the right, you see here that actually within 2 or 3 days, it has widely spread through these organoids. And we know though that indeed that the intestine is a major target for this virus, although patients get sick because of their lung invasion. We did a lot of things with these organoids, but I think this is one important experiment. Chloroquine was proposed by a French lab to be a fantastic drug to block infection by the virus. Now, virology labs almost always use these vero cells. These are African green monkey kidney cells. They're much like fibroblasts. And indeed, in these cells, chloroquine kills the infection. At 1 micromolar is the IC50. At 10 micromolar, there's essentially no infection at all. The exact same concentrations in our organoids do nothing. They have no effect. And as you probably all know, hydroxychloroquine has been given to tens, if not hundreds of thousands of patients worldwide, but has never helped a patient and only has caused side effects, particularly of cardiological origin. Now, why is that? It now turns out, and I'll don't show you the data here, that the way the virus enters and infects the vero cells is through endocytosis. So it binds to the ACE2 receptor. You see it on the left here. It's then endocytosed and then eventually released by cathepsin L and B from the endosome. And then the virus, the viral RNA enters the cytoplasm. That's a step that's, that can be blocked by hydroxychloroquine, very well known. But what happens in the primary epithelial cells that, in, that exist in normal organoids is the virus attaches to the same ACE2 receptor, but it's then the spike protein is activated through cleavage by TMPRSS2, by a surface protease. And now the virus directly fuses with the outer membrane of the cell and injects its RNA into cytoplasm. There is no endocytosis, and therefore hydroxychloroquine has no effect on the infection of these primary epithelial cells. So my advice here would be that to virologists, if you want to see if a drug works, not only test it on these easy to work with cell lines, but maybe also take the step to a slightly more difficult to grow organoid and see if what you're finding really holds up in something that's closer to normal biology. And with that, I'd like to thank you very much for your attention. And I think there's some time for Q&A for questions.
Thank you. Wonderful. I hope you can hear the applause, Hans. It's real applause. It's not one of those artificial Zoom applause things. So that was a fabulous talk. Thank you so much. And I want to just start by congratulating you on doing something that is so important in terms of allowing the public to understand what our science is about. I think, you know, the way you've always tried to make sure that there are ways of visualizing the processes you work on has been incredible. So thank you for that. So are there questions? And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to invite people to actually come and ask the question here. It's actually more interactive, I've found. So don't be frightened. You can stand up and come. I'm going to ask the first question, and then some of you can come and ask another question, and I'll move away. So Hans, I just wanted to ask you one question. I mean, it's amazing the transplantation that you showed, for example, in the context of inflammatory bowel disease, and the fact that, you know, you really don't see with these cells that there's any indication of cancer. But I was still wondering, you know, to what extent are these cells maintained in terms of genetic integrity? I mean, I'm sure this has been looked at, but when I gave my lectures on this whole topic, for me, that's still one of the mysteries. You know, do these adult stem cells maintain a degree of genetic integrity that, you know, sort of is better than other cells, or is it something about, you know, the way they are preserved in their niche? And then there's no reason to think that they will actually have a higher mutation rate So was that something that you looked at? Obviously now, particularly with a therapeutic perspective, it's something I'm sure that is on everyone's mind.
So I guess at first worry would be that they lose their telomeres, and that's not happening. So they have high TERT expression, yeah. And the telomeres actually in culture become longer if we measure this over the years. We know the mutation rate, somatic mutation rate of CRIP stem cells. That's about 40 single base changes per year, so a little bit less than one per week. So if you're 60 years old, you'll have 60 times 52 times 40 mutations in your genome of each of your stem cells. In culture, the rate is probably twice as high, so they're safer in the gut than they are in culture. And we see mostly oxygen radical induced changes. So they undergo mutations faster than they would go in the body. However, there appears not to be any selection for cancer mutations. Cancer cells tend to grow slower, much to our surprise, also when we do this directly from patients. So I'm sure that every once in a while we'll hit a cancer gene, but that cell is typically lost from the population. Yeah. If we select out, so if you, for instance, select for P53 mutant cells by adding Nutlin, a small molecule, we can get them quite easily from these cultures, but they will never accumulate in culture.
Yeah.
So I think it's probably also what the CRIPs do is that they, because the cells are always dividing, that there are sort of mechanisms in action, competitive mechanisms that always favor the wild type cell over the mutant cells.
And now with your system of introducing the mutations yourselves, you can really follow this evolution of cancer cells and their capacity to be outnumbered or to outgrow. So it's fantastic, the perspectives that are there.